All right, good evening. I'm Tarek. I'm an alcoholic addict. And it's my honor to introduce the speaker this evening, who you guys have already gotten to know a little bit. God brought Brandon into my life in September of 2011. And we have walked this path together since that time. And we continue to deepen our relationship by sharing our experience with God. I know that's what my relationship with Brandon is based on. And all kinds of things can spring from that. I am his sponsor, but I would have to say that I feel like he's my sponsor sometimes. That's the relationship I have with a lot of men that I sponsor, because I'm not a sponsor that believes that the sponsor always walks in front of the sponsees and he's always the teacher and they're always the students. I learn a great deal from the men I sponsor, specifically the ones that have committed to working with others and deepening their experience with prayer and meditation and making amends and developing the sixth sense, awareness of the consciousness of the presence of God. And he's my friend, he's my pal, he's my brother, and I love him tremendously, and you guys are in for a real treat. And with that, I give you Brandon.
I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brandon. I always seem to start off my talks the same way, so why change it now? I introduce myself as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do that quite regularly because I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the back of the book, in the traditions, there's a long form and a short form of the traditions. The short form of the third tradition says the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Kind of short and to the sweet. I think it's necessary when we first get sober that is the only requirement, is the desire to stop drinking. But there's a long form of the third tradition, which was actually the original one, which says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. I expect that tonight, as I talk, and this weekend, as you hear from me, you will identify that I suffered from alcoholism. From time to time, the alcoholic mind will still creep in. But a requirement of membership of an Alcoholics Anonymous is that you have to be an alcoholic. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Another requirement. I have to want to get well. I cannot be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and want to stay sick for the rest of my life. I actually have to do everything in my power to connect with that thing that keeps me sober and try to get well, try to get to a recovered state. The long form of the third tradition goes on to say, nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. So there's a lot more to the long form. And behind me is the short form of the steps. You can find these on pages 59 and 60 of your big book. And there are one or two lines that kind of summarize the essence of the steps. But as you saw when we had it up on the screen when it was working, and when we went through earlier, that there's a lot more to the steps than just simply what's on the sheet. There's levels, and there's depth, and there's understanding, and there's digging in and getting to a deeper relationship with those steps so that I can be more effective in carrying the message that I got well and God did it, and I was nothing more than a channel. And so I hope tonight that I'll share some of that with you. Because of the format, it's kind of, I really don't really know how. Usually, kind of get up here and let it rip and go with whatever I feel the power is telling me to speak to you about. And I really haven't had a whole lot of time or meditation to really think about this. And so, which is kind of cool because that means that whatever I talk about is what I'm supposed to talk about. I like to set the stage usually with reading some things. And this was the meditation for today out of another book that I like to meditate out. It says, I accept my own spiritual and physical perfection. My body is the temple of the living God. It is the spiritual substance. I have perfect confidence in my heart that God's life-giving spirit is my life. Since God is my life and God is eternal, my life is eternal. Therefore, I cannot be separated from God, from good, from perfection. If I would renew body, mind, and affairs, I must first cause my imagination to rise above them. The supreme ruler, omnipresent, therefore existing at the very center of my thought, the Christ within me, really has the power to make all things new. The perfect life of God now expresses itself through me, and every part of my body expresses its innate perfection and wholeness. As the sun dissolves the mist, so does my knowledge of truth dissolve all pain and discord. I know the truth about myself as a child of God, and that truth makes me free. I am free because the power of a living spirit is my power, and it remolds and recreates my body after the likeness of the perfect pattern of God. I open wide the doorway of my consciousness to a greater influx from Almighty Spirit. I know that the all-conquering power of Spirit is with me. I accept my birthright as a divine being of manifesting the life, love, peace, strength, harmony, and joy of God, the infinite life that dwells within and incarnates itself in me as me. There's probably a lot of you that heard me read that and said, what the hell is that all saying? What was the essence of it? And to me, the essence of it is that I'm one with God. And the sooner that I realize that I'm one with God, I'm not God, but I'm a part of God, just like the wave's a part of the ocean, it's not necessarily the ocean. And that this power that I've gained access to through the steps actually wants me to live a full and happy life. Actually wants me to live my life in a way that is beyond anything that I can conceive. And all I have to do is align myself with that power. And the problem I have is that I was born one day and somebody came up to me when I was, you know, younger than able to comprehend what was really going on. And I did something and I got a positive result. And I did other things and I got a negative result. And I started to program my life based on, I do this, get a good feeling. I do this, get a bad feeling. And then my life transformed to a point where I go through an entire existence with the conditions of my life programming me how to think, act, and believe. And the problem is that if you've got a mind like mine, it processes incorrectly sometimes. And sometimes that information comes in and I twist it. I think that it's not quite right. And in fact, I'll still do that today. Somebody will do something to me that I don't like and I may call Tarek and I may tell Tarek the story and I realize when I'm telling Tarek the story that when I tell him these certain things, he's like, oh, that guy's a jerk. And so I'm like, hey, I'm going to work with those. And then I call the next guy, and then I use those things, and I change the story a little bit more. And then I talk to the next person, I change the story a little bit more. To the point where I'm constantly changing the story of how I perceive things based on the response I get from you. And so I create all these different stage characters around my life that tell me how to react in certain situations. And the inventory process that we go through in the steps helps to break that down for truth. And one of the things I believe I'm going to talk about tonight is you're getting so much of a dose from us of the big book and our perspective on it is to really kind of distinguish what's different about what we do. What's different about the way that we approach the steps versus the way that a lot of the people within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous do. And one of the first ways, and one of the way that we write inventory, and we'll go through that, I think tomorrow sometime, is we really, a lot of people get to the fourth step, and there's column one, you know, these are real easy. Column one, who I'm pissed at. Column two, why I'm pissed at them. I mean, that's not very hard. I can write that in no time at all. And then there's a way out there that's got this fourth step, or the third column of the fourth step, where it's does that affect my self-esteem? Does it affect my pride? Does it affect my ambition? Does it affect my security, personal relations, sex relations, and pocketbook? And if I answer yes to any of those, I put a check mark. How does this affect my self-esteem? I don't know. It does. How does this affect my pride? It does. I never look at what really goes on. And for me, the experience of the freedom of inventory comes when I go through that process and I explain how it affects my self-esteem, how it affects my pride, and how it affects all these things to the point where I start to see the lies in black and white for how I'm not, how I don't really approach the world correctly, and how my view's really slanted, and how I try to present things in a certain way. And then I get to the fourth column, and I look and I write out how this affects my, or how my fear drives this, and how my self-centeredness drives it, how my selfishness drives it, and what's the fourth one? I'm missing one. My dishonesty drives it. And I start to see it and I dive into it. And so if I've done the fourth step properly, if I've gone deep and I've really looked at it, and I go to another person to read that fourth step and the fifth step, and I review that with them, and then they identify a couple areas that maybe I'm not seeing things. I remember inventory I wrote a couple years ago. I think it was the third person I read it to. I read it to the first person, and I'll get into this in a minute. I read it to the first person, and they identified a bunch of things. And then I read it to the second person, and they identified a bunch of things. And so I read it to the third person, and the guy looks at me and goes, "Wow, you're one entitled son of a bitch." And I had to look at him. I go, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." And it was so funny to me because it was like the first two people that I read the inventory to didn't see any of it. But yet by the time I got to the third guy and I'm pointing it out to him, he's seeing it from a different perspective and he's starting to point this out to me. And I really had to go back and look at that and see, and he was absolutely right, is that in all the situations that I had written about that I walked around with a sense of entitlement, like the world owed me something. And I didn't even know that was going on up in here. I didn't have any idea that that's what was going on in my head. And I hit on a couple of things while I was talking about that, is that the big book talks about a business that takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. And what's a regular inventory? You know, most businesses do that on a yearly basis, or at least a semi-annual basis. And so the guys that in my network, we look at that and we sit there and we say, okay, that means that we need to go back through these things on a regular basis, either yearly or semi-yearly. Right now I'm on pace for about every year and a half. I've gone through them four times. And I'll explain to you the results that I got from sharing that with some other people. And having a new experience with God. And when we go back through the steps, we don't just start at the fourth step. We don't just write inventory. We go all the way back to the beginning. we go back to see how am I, because the thought that's probably going to take me out of here, the thought that's probably going to get me drunk, is the one that says, okay, and I can tell you this happened. I was about 2 years sober. I'm going back through the steps for the second time. My sobriety date is June 15, 2011. My first sponsor that took me through the steps had an incredible experience with him, but he concluded somewhere September, October, you know, 3-4 months into my sobriety, he came to the conclusion that he wasn't an alcoholic. And he went out and started drinking again. I mean, when I talked to him, I said, so what's up? And he's like, well, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. He actually said that. And I was like, why? And he's like, well, I just don't think I am. So he came to the conclusion that he could go drink and smoke pot. So he did for 3 years. So I sat down with Tarek. I'm about 2 years sober, and I'm going back through the steps, and my life had kind of straightened out a little bit. Some of the wreckage of my past had kind of floated away, and things had kind of calmed down, and I started to wonder maybe if I hadn't made too much of an issue out of this whole thing. Maybe I was too stressed out at work. You know, maybe the woman that I was married to was just driving me nuts. You know, maybe I just drank. I was a heavy drinker. And so, you know, it's so great to have somebody guide you through this, because it was suggested by my sponsor that maybe I, when I go back to the first step, I ask God to show me whether or not I was really an alcoholic. And so I followed directions and said, God, will you please show me whether or not I'm an alcoholic? And you know, prayers are funny things. And I was telling somebody this earlier, is that if you actually ask that question to God of like, hey, will you please show me this? God will do that for you. And it came in the form of about a week-long barrage of memories that I had forgotten about, of just memory after memory after memory of pounding into my brain that it was absolutely obvious that I was alcoholic. And one of the experiences that came back, I like to qualify myself so that you guys don't think that I just like to get up here and share experience just because I think it's cool standing behind a part of a tree. So I had a memory came into mind where I had this night where a bunch of us went out drinking after work. That wasn't that uncommon. But it was at a particular establishment where we like to give money to people, and they did some things. And they have these special rooms that you can go to that are more fun than where the other people go. So we did that. And my wife was working overnight at the time, and she kept calling. And I was really fearful that I might accidentally pick up the phone, and she would obviously hear where we were, because there's, you know, pretty distinct noises in the background going on. And so I turned my phone off, took the battery out. So there were a bunch of us there. We had a couple drinks, a couple guys left. We had a couple more drinks, a couple guys left, a couple drinks, a couple guys left. You know, these people that had responsibility and stuff, they went home. And it was down to me and one other guy. And we ended up, I don't think we closed the place down. I think we really ran out of money, because I remember leaving the place and I was driving home and I had all the windows down and I was eating this tin of Altoids, thinking that if I had enough in my system that maybe that would, like, you know, I wouldn't smell like I had been drinking. But I had also identified that I was having a lot of trouble driving. When an alcoholic comes to the conclusion that they should probably not be driving, it's bad. And I was at this conclusion this night. And so, but I was really close to home. I was really close to home, and I was getting off the exit. And it's this exit where you get off and you can head either east or west. And when you're headed east, you have to stay going east. And if you're headed west, you keep going west. And I head east to go home, and I come around the bend, and there's a roadblock. And they're stopping people, and they're checking people, and then the other lane is the cars pulled over and putting them in cop cars, and they put me in lane 2 to check me, and the guy comes up, says, you've been drinking? And of course, I said no. He quizzes me a little bit longer as to whether or not I was drinking. Leaves, comes back. He ends up letting me go, which is amazing because it was it was clear that I was overserved. And so I pull in the driveway, go to the fridge, grab a beer, sit down on the couch, and do what any alcoholic would do, which is to celebrate the fact that I'm not in jail. Well, remember, my phone's unplugged, so the wife is very concerned because she can't get a hold of me. So she leaves work. She comes home 10, 15 minutes behind me and goes through the same roadblock, assumes that the reason why she can't get a hold of me is because I must be in jail. So she's got all her fears and all her internal issues going on. She comes into the house, and I'm sitting on the couch drinking a beer. Needless to say, she was not pleased with me. Argument ensues. I smash my head in the wall because she tells me I'm crazy, and I say, this is what crazy people do. And she calls me an alcoholic, and that's so absurd. She said, you're an alcoholic. And so, you know, I don't think I can really capture the essence of what I'm trying to say here, but let me try. So she calls me an alcoholic, and I want to prove to her that I am not an alcoholic. So I've come up with this great idea that I'm going to go to the fridge and take the case of beer out of the fridge, and I'm going to dump it in the trash can and proclaim that an alcoholic could not do that. I was very proud of myself. She didn't take it as reasonable evidence that I wasn't an alcoholic. But so I did what I do, which is, you know, passed out on the couch, and then the next day try to, you know, still her forebodings by, you know, telling her that it was no big deal, and, you know, probably cooked her a nice dinner and everything's good. And so, you know, Sunday rolls around, and I think there's probably a good football game going on or something like that, and I'm pulling the beers out of the trash can, rinsing them off, and putting them back in the fridge because, well, the heat's off now. She doesn't think I'm an alcoholic anymore, and we're getting along pretty good. And I realize when 2 years sober, when I think back to the story, I realize, holy shit, that's pretty insane to go through all that stuff and think that that's normal. And then the conclusion I came to is I calculated it. And then I went on drinking for 9 more years after that. And so the conclusion I came to as a result of that is that pretty much everybody that I was dealing with from that day on was dealing with a completely insane person. And that, you know, for a long time when it came to making amends, it was like, well, I could justify it because they weren't as nice to me and I don't need to make that amend. But the realization I came to was that if all these people are dealing with a completely insane person, they're not responsible for their actions. That the actions of me on them created the scenario that they acted the way that they did. And so, you know, talking about crumbling your idea of the people that I should never have to make amends to, because it was just like, wow, I guess that really, you know, most of the people that I needed to make amends to came in that 9 years of drinking. And so I had this lovely experience sometime later where, you know, I had a particular evening where I didn't shoot myself in the face for some reason. I wanted to. I knew where the gun was, and I couldn't go in the room. And I couldn't seem to there was a force field in front of the door. There's really no other way to explain it. I stood outside that door probably for 3 or 4 hours. And then ended up driving to my parents and sleeping on their back patio and waking up the next morning with the realization of what had almost happened the night before and having no explanation for why I didn't do it, but having the realization that I really didn't want to die and I wanted to continue to live. And that experience, as I explained to you earlier, sobered me up for 4 days. I knew that the alcohol had something to do with me wanting to shoot myself in the face, but it wasn't enough. It simply wasn't enough for me to not drink. And so 2 weeks later, my wife on a family vacation on an island with no bridge announces to me and her family at the same time that she no longer wants to be married to me. And in that moment, I lose the house, the wife, the kids, the car, everything that I thought was important. So I figured after vacation, I would just immerse myself in work and dedicate myself to work, and that she would want to get back together with me because I was so successful. And I showed up to work on Monday, and they fired me. So when I showed up in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was probably about 2 weeks sober. The second part of that first step was pretty clear to me. The fact that my life was unmanageable was crystal clear to me. But as I told you earlier, it took me almost 2 years to really grasp the entirety of that first part of the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol. And I think anybody that knew me prior to me getting sober would, except for the people that drank like me, because they didn't want me to be an alcoholic, because if I was an alcoholic, then they might be an alcoholic too. So everybody else in my life would have said, yeah, we knew you had a problem well before you stopped. But I couldn't get it, because I was so blinded by the reality that I was living in, which was a false reality. And so going back to going through the inventory on a regular basis, the first inventory I wrote when I got sober was life-changing. I mean, I wrote the three inventories. I wrote the resentments. Not a whole lot showed up there. I wrote the fear. I'm a big, tough guy. There was no fear. I don't have any of that stuff. But then when I got to the sex inventory and I wrote the sex inventory, what became crystal clear to me is that the way that I treated women was the same way that I treated basically everything and everybody in my life. And that I constantly tried to dominate relationships. I constantly tried to manipulate things to get my needs, so get what I thought I needed. So my first inventory was real clear. The sex inventory part was the thing that really kind of shine the light on the defects that I had. 2 years sober, when I went back through inventory, it was the resentment inventory really showed me, oh, this is how I'm not getting along with God's children. When about a little over a year and a half ago, I went through inventory and the fear inventory in that one. You know, the longer I'm here, the longer I do this work, the deeper I go, the more that I realize that fear dominates every area of my life. And it's shocking to me that I didn't know this. It's shocking to me that I had no idea that fear was running my life, and that fear is the driving mechanism for most of my resentments and my sexual misconduct and everything else. And so, really powerful experience. And then I'm right now, circle and triangle, I'll locate myself now. There's a group of guys and I that are going through the steps, and we just finished the fifth step. We just finished the sex. We did a conduct inventory this time, because most of us are in relationships and we're not really causing a whole lot of sexual harm out there. So we started looking at it the way that as a conduct inventory. So we just finished that up. We've kind of stalled out a little bit trying to figure out how to finish doing the steps as a group together. But that's where I'm at in that. 10th step, I mean, I'm in it constantly. I've got a group of probably six guys that pretty much know everything that's going on in my life pretty much at all times. And that have spiritual consent where they can call me out on my shit even if I don't see it. They'll because it's more important to them that I stay alive than for my feelings to matter. 11th step, my morning routine of meditation has been somewhat lacking, but I meditate multiple times over the course of the day. The intention of sitting down and reading has been sporadic lately, but it's But it's one of the greatest practices that I've experienced in sobriety, is just furthering and cultivating this experience through meditation. And my prayers happen constantly over the course of the day. And they take on all sorts of forms of yelling and screaming and whatever else at God. And he's okay with it, or it's okay with it, whatever it is. And then so that's where I'm at in the recovery part of the circle and triangle. The unity, I have a home group in Cocaine Anonymous that I used to have a service position at. I do not now. We meet on Monday nights, and we go through the steps as a group out of the big book. And then Wednesday night is my home group, my AA home group. We go through the book. We read a paragraph or two and pause and talk about it and go on. And sometimes we get two paragraphs read in an hour meeting. Sometimes we read a bunch of pages. And then I have a step study that's out of the 12 and 12 that I attend as often as I can. I have four kids and a wife and a full-time job and a bunch of farm chores that I got to do. So that meeting is probably the most lacking out of the ones that I go to. And then I attend a recovery-based meditation meeting on Sunday nights. That's my unity. I'm active in all those. If I don't show up, people ask why I'm not there. If I'm not going to show up, I text them, let people know that I'm not coming and why. I don't hide at the meetings. People know who I am, and they know that I'm supposed to be there and that it's part of my recovery. And then in service, you know, this is kind of a hybrid tonight, because we're actually carrying the message to you guys through the course of the weekend. But the things that I do in the meetings, that's service to the fellowship. But the service that I do is sitting down with another alcoholic and taking them through the steps. And my life is full in that matter. I'm constantly sponsoring somewhere between 3 and 5 guys, and I've got certain time slots at certain meetings that we meet before or after the meeting. And I've got guys that are all over the spectrum. I've got a guy in step 2. I've got a guy in step 4, one that's getting ready to start 5. I got another guy that's in 12. And then I've got some other people that I don't sponsor, but I'm taking them through the steps. And to me, that's the joy of life as in recovery, is carrying that message to somebody else and seeing the lights come on. I mean, it's kind of cool to watch this evening, is that there's certain ones of you that you're coming alive at different places. And like when we started, most of you were sleeping. You were just kind of like, whatever, I don't want to be here. And then we'll say certain things, and it'll be interesting, because a guy that'll have his eyes down the entire meeting, all of a sudden will look up like, what the hell was that? And so it's fun, even in this room, to watch you guys engage, to watch you guys light up. And that's what... That to me, it's nothing Tarek and I are doing. It's the fact that there's a power in your life that loves you more than you could possibly imagine, that's going, hey, wake up. And then you guys do, and then you start getting engaged, and then you start asking questions, and you start realizing, hey, there's more to this stuff. And the more to this stuff is the rest of the 12th step. The more to this stuff is the practicing the principles in all our affairs. Not that you guys could, because we can't house you, but it would be fun for you guys to follow us around for a couple of days, Tarek and I, to actually see if we do this shit. See if we, you know, I mean, we sound good up here. I mean, I think we do. We got invited, so we must sound like halfway decent. But come follow us in our daily lives and see our struggles and see how we actually try to practice these principles and try to see how. You know, there's another thing. There's so many things that we hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous that just there's no reference to this thing called living amends in the big book. But yet, it's people. You talk about the eighth and the ninth step anytime in a meeting, somebody's going to talk about living amends. It's not in the book. The book says direct amends to all persons we had harmed. And so it doesn't say we didn't make amends to past girlfriends. It doesn't say that we didn't make amends to people that, you know, that we thought wronged us. I mean, it says all. Does anybody know what all means? All? Everyone? And so this living amends crap that we hear about is really the 12th step, practicing the principles in all my affairs. Is I have to practice these principles in all my affairs if I intend to live a happy, whole, and sober life. Because if I don't, then that area is going to get me. And I love it because there's a buddy of mine that I took through the steps a couple years ago. And he was a couple years sober, and this guy was rocking a pretty good program. And we're going through his inventory, and everything's work-related. Like, he's pissed off at all these people at work. He's fearful of all this stuff at work. And I just asked him, so have you considered that practicing these principles in all our affairs means all our affairs? And he just looks at me and he goes, you mean like work? I was like, well, is that all or not? And he's a smart dude. So it's one of those things where it's like, the look on his face was just like, huh. And the transformation that I've seen in this guy over the last 2 years as it relates to work is just, it's phenomenal. I mean, the guy was doing well, but he's killing it now. And like, where he used to be this guy that, like, everybody ran and went the other way when he was walking down the hall, now, like, they're, like, asking him to do stuff. And they're asking him to, you know, get engaged in other things. And I have another guy that I sponsor that, and it's baffling to me that if you would have known how messed up and how self-centered and how terrible I was towards people in general, back in my drinking days, like, the fact that anybody wants to have anything to do with me or actually comes to me for help, it feels weird, because it's like, and I'm blind to it. And so another one of our buddies, got his daughter got married 2 weeks ago, and I mean, the presence that this guy had during his daughter's wedding, I mean, just, he was almost goofy, like it was just like he was just floating around the place because he was so just there. And a couple years ago, this guy would have been making an ass out of himself. And this is a guy that came to AA when his daughter was one. And she's 26 now, getting married, and he's got less than 2 years sober, and he finally got hooked up with a message of depth and weight. And he's sober, and it's like, and I've talked to him about, like, what's it like to go through all that and then to get sober through the big book and work the steps? Like, do you regret all those years? And his answer is a simple one, is that I couldn't do any different. I didn't have any knowledge that there was anything out there. And so at the end of the wedding, the guy, I gave his wife a hug and said that it was, I told her how beautiful the wedding was. And she gives me a big hug, and she tells me that she's so thankful for me being in her husband's life, and that I mean so much to him, and that she just says all these nice things. And I'm driving home with my wife, and I said to her, you know, this is what his wife said to me, and I'm like, I guess I'm just an idiot because I can't see this stuff. I can't see that I actually have some use to other people. And that's, to me, that's so cool that God has put these people in my life that I'm helping and I don't even know I'm helping. I don't even know that I'm affecting a change in them, because all I'm doing is sharing my experience. All I'm doing is showing up and explaining what I've done to the best of my ability and my interpretation of things, and these people's lives get changed. It's the craziest thing. And I got another guy that He's 4 months sober. He's been bouncing in and out of this thing for years. And, like, to watch the lights come on in this guy has been the coolest thing, because it's just like, in 4 months, the guy's gone from this hopeless alcoholic to, like, following a dream of his that he never even thought was possible. I remember the day he called me and he was looking for a job, and I said, well, if you could do anything you want to do, what would it be? And he's like, well, it's stupid. I want to go fly airplanes. I'm like, well, then go fly airplanes. And he said, well, you know, it costs so much. I don't know. And he gave me all these reasons, and I just said, well, that sucks. And he said, what? I said, it sucks that your God's not powerful enough to give you the opportunity to go do that. Huh. Well, guess what? On Monday of this week, he was flying an airplane. Now, he's not licensed or anything. We don't have to worry about that. But he actually went and did it. And he's following his dream, and he's doing this thing that he never thought was possible. And, you know, the coolest thing that is going through this experience with people and trying to actually, when you realize that you have the responsibility, just not just for you, but for the people that you sponsor, the accountability that shows up in your life, the doing the thing that is correct and that you should do because it's what you're supposed to do, and not because you, it doesn't matter that you don't want to do it, but actually doing the right things because you know you're being watched. You know that people are checking you out to see if you're actually doing this stuff right. It propels you through this stuff. It propels you deeper into the work. The guys that ask you the questions that you sponsor that you can't, that take your experience so much deeper so that you're forced to look deeper. You're challenged to find a deeper relationship with God. I mean, that's why sponsorship's so important. And then to actually carry that deeper relationship into all your relationships. My relationship and my ability to deal with my kids is so much greater because of sponsorship. It's because I get to see what works and doesn't work. I can't just be the authoritarian person that just dictates to everybody that this is how you're going to do it because the guys flick me off and walk away. My kids can't flick me off, but I get into this relationship with them where I respect them. I respect their opinion. I can ask questions of my kids like, is that important to you? And they can tell me things like, well, yeah. And I'm like, well, then let's do something about it. Living within that 12th step and practicing 10 and 11, the depth of your life becomes so much more to the point where it's beyond comprehension. It's like the reading that I read, like that made complete sense to me. And I'm confident there were people that when I read it were like, what does that mean? Because I've got this connection with this power. I've got this connection with a depth and understanding of how to live life that I never had before. And I mean, what I shared with you before, I mean, those are two stories out of my life of me wanting to shoot myself in the face and me like acting like an idiot, being drunk. That was my life. That I sensed at an early, when I was a child, I used to get down underneath the covers and try to breathe really heavy so that maybe I would suffocate myself and then I'd get too hot and then I'd get out from underneath the covers. But that disease of not fitting in was existent forever. And when I took that first drink, all it did was settle that down. And the problem was at the end, that drink didn't settle anything down. It made it worse. And so for me getting to a place where I can get up here and have no idea what I'm talking about and probably will have no idea what I talked about unless I go back and listen to this talk, and to actually seemingly have the audience paying attention to me. I mean, maybe you're not paying attention, maybe you're just looking through me, and that's fine. But to go from a place where I was broke and homeless at the age of 37, moving in with my parents and becoming really unemployable. That's the place that I reached. For a while, I would lose a job, I'd get a better one. I'd lose a job, I'd get a better one. I'd lose a job, I'd get a better one. At the end, it was lose a job, get a worse one. Lose a job, get a worse one. And until it was finally like nobody wanted to hire me. And to actually be here and be invited to come somewhere to actually talk about an experience with this creator that I really can't explain. It's quite magical for me. It's quite mind-blowing that that could even possibly happen. And I guess I'm just glad that you guys were here for it. So thanks for letting me share.